Hello and welcome to Baylor Connections, a conversation series with the people shaping our future. I'm Derek Smith, your host, and each week we go in-depth with Baylor leaders, professors, administrators, and more, discussing higher education, research, student life, and other important topics like today's immigration law. Baylor Connections is a part of our partnership with KWBU-FM, airing each Friday morning at 11 on KWBU and is available online, baylor.edu/connections. Our guest today is Laura Hernandez, a professor in the Baylor Law School and an expert on immigration law, insurance law, civil rights, and the separation of church and state. She joined Baylor 10 years ago, 2008, and has become a leading scholar on the issues facing immigrants to the U.S. Laura is the co-founder of the Baylor Law Immigration Clinic, which has assisted hundreds of Central Texans with their immigration needs. She also coaches a number of Baylor moot court teams and has won three national titles. A lot on your plate, Laura. We thank you for making time to join us today on Baylor Connections. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. I appreciate being here.
Well, we appreciate you coming and look forward to talking about this very timely topic and the work you do and the work Baylor students do with immigrants, recent immigrants who have made their way here to Central Texas. And, of course, the ramifications go far beyond Central Texas as well. I want to start off with talking about something that Baylor Law School Dean Brad Tobin has often said that's really become kind of a mission statement of its own. He says, the law is a calling to serve. How has that been evident and shaped in your own work?
Well, I have been fortunate in that, well, for 12 years, at the beginning of my career, I was actually part of what we call big law. So I defended Fortune 50 companies against various lawsuits in Los Angeles and then in San Antonio. So when I was doing that kind of work, it was very demanding. I wasn't able to, or I actually just didn't have the time to have as many pro bono activities. However, when I joined the faculty at Baylor Law School, I really was able to, act on the ability to give back, and we call that our pro bono activities, you know, basically helping to serve the underserved segments of our population. And one of the things that I recognized when I came to Waco and joined the law faculty is that Waco has a very large immigrant community, and they are very underserved. There are only a handful of nonprofit organizations that assist this immigrant community. And really, as for legal services, when I first came, there were none. Now, 10 years later, we have Mission Waco. We have the immigration clinic at the law school. But if we are not able to handle those legal needs, then Waco residents need to go to Dallas or to Austin.
Well, you saw a need, and you worked to fill that void. You mentioned the Baylor Law Immigration Clinic. Just about 6 years have passed since you founded it. And take us inside how the clinic was formed a little bit, how it began, and the services that you saw the need to provide and that you now provide.
Well, at the law school, we do not run our clinics the way other law schools do because of our curriculum requirements. So we're on a quarter system. Other law schools are on semester systems. So we have to be very precise and very mindful of our students' schedules. So when all of this was inspired and came about in 2012, because that was the year that President Obama directed that the DACA program be put into place by the Department of Homeland Security. Now, DACA stands for Deferred Action Childhood Arrival. And basically what President Obama directed Janet Napolitano, who was then the Secretary of Homeland Security, to do was to, in essence, exercise what we call prosecutorial discretion. So in the world of immigration, there are lots of people that our government may want to remove or deport. And obviously, the bad actors are at the top of that list. The murderers, the burglars, the people who are committing crimes, those are the non-citizens that the government wants to remove first. On that spectrum, though, there are a group of non-citizens who are here without proper without the proper documentation, but are otherwise living good lives. They're not getting into trouble. They've got good moral character. And so what DACA did was say, If you're one of those people, and the reason you're here without documentation is because you came as a child, because your parents brought you, you're really kind of innocent in terms of coming to our country without permission. And if you're in school and you've got a high school diploma and you're of a certain age, what we're going to do is we're going to put you at the bottom of that deportation list. And because you're at the bottom of that list, we're also going to allow you to work legally in the United States. And so as long as you come out of the shadows, ask for this DACA authorization, we will allow you to stay at least temporarily. So in order to get that kind of status, there were a lot of forms that an applicant had to fill out. And the forms are really aimed at lawyers. There were some questions in there that were kind of tricky. Mm-hmm. And so if you didn't have legal training, you might answer the wrong way because you didn't understand the question. So we at the law school, I had a student who is now started the American Gateway's office in Waco, who was very passionate about this and approached me and said, can we put together some kind of activity to help them? And just seeing her enthusiasm and her passion for it, I said, yeah, let's try to get a clinic together. And it was very, very well received, both by the students at the law school. They were very, very anxious to help, as well as by the administration at the law school. You mentioned Dean Tobin. He has supported our activities from day one. So we, you know, put all of the forms on computers. We encrypted them so that people could not gain access to that information. We advertised. And in 2012, I mean, we were really overrun. We helped a lot of people that first year and actually the first couple of years. It was exciting. Our students loved it. And I think part of what our students learned from the experience was that the people, the non-citizens who were asking for the DACA authorizations, they just looked like Americans. They were young. They tended to be high school students. And you would have no idea that they were not Americans. So they spoke English. They were of good moral character. They hoped to go to college. It was a very heartwarming kind of situation, and it also let our students understand what legal activities can do and how meaningful they are. And of course, all of our services were free. The DACA applicant had to pay a fee to the government of, at the time, it was $465. But our services were free, and I was just really excited about it because I think it was the first time that this portion of the Waco community had ever come to our law school.
You know, as we talk about DACA, obviously the situations surrounding it are very fluid. There's an element of political football certainly to it. What can you tell us about where we are now in the debate here in early spring 2018? Where are we now? And what are some, what's your interactions like with the people you serve in these situations in terms of what they're facing, just given that fluidity?
Well, in terms of the people who hold the DACA authorizations that have not expired yet, there's a lot of fear and there's a lot of uncertainty. A few of them are enrolled at our law school and they're wondering, am I going to be able to practice law after I've gone through this program for 3 years? So there's that. And you're right, DACA is very much in flux. So just to get everybody caught up, DACA was something that was an executive decision. Now, it was not an executive order. It was just merely President Obama directing the Department of Homeland Security to do something. Well, live by the sword, die by the sword. If a president can direct it to happen, another president can direct it to go away. And that's exactly what happened when President Trump was elected. Ultimately, last September in 2017, he directed Attorney General Jeff Sessions to rescind the program. Now, if you're wondering why, you know, it seems like a whipsaw type of effect. It's like it's here one day and it's not here the next. Well, the reason for that is because the only part of our government that can make immigration law is Congress. When Congress does something, then it's permanent. If the president does something, it's not permanent any longer. So that's why there's this kind of uncertainty. So September happens, the program is rescinded, and we came up, the immigration clinic opened up for a little while trying to process renewals that the government said that they would still take. So on another track, there were legal challenges to the rescission. And one of them was successful, and it was a lawsuit that was filed in Northern California, and a San Francisco federal district court judge said, you did not rescind the program properly. There's this whole body of law that agencies, that government agencies have to follow. And that law has lots of, you know, step one, step two, step three, and you've got to hit every box. So we're going to roll back the rescission. So So now it's back up. And we're going to roll back the rescission until we can consider what you did on the merits. So in other words, we're going to put it back to the way it was before until this lawsuit plays out. DACA is back now. So the Department of Homeland Security said, okay, and they started accepting renewals again. And as a result, we have open the clinic again to try to help people who are now qualified to renew during this later timeline. Now, all of this is a caveat, of course, because this is a lawsuit, it is capable of appeal to higher courts. And as a matter of fact, it has been appealed, or it is appealed to the United States Supreme Court. And whatever they decide might cause it either to stay in place or to go away again. We just have to wait and see. Or Congress acts, because right now Congress is considering the DREAM Act. And if they pass that DREAM Act, well, then there's no more uncertainty. It's permanent because they have the ability to make this law. And if that happens, then the immigration clinic will help DACA recipients to adjust to a road to residency.
We are talking to Baylor Law Professor Laura Hernandez, an immigration law expert and co-founder of the Baylor Law Immigration Clinic. And we've talked a lot about what the current events are and the kind of the direct service you're giving to DACA holders here in Central Texas. But now I want to transition a little bit to your research. You've done a lot of research specifically as it relates to recent immigrants to the U.S. What's unique about the experiences of recent immigrants to the U.S. that appeals to you to serve them?
Well, to be perfectly honest, my family is our recent arrivals. Myself, as a matter of fact, my mother was born in Mexico and came to the United States when she was 8 or 9 years old. And so my siblings and I are the first, you know, generation that have been in the United States. And I am so grateful for the opportunities that have been given me. I grew up in the poor side of San Antonio, and just through a lot of hard work and diligence was able to attend Stanford University, go to law school, become a law professor. And this from a family one generation ago that were living in houses with dirt floors in Mexico. So
amazing.
This is, to me, the beauty and the reason why people want to come to the United States of America, because of that kind of opportunity that is given to anyone who has the dream and has the work ethic and has the desire. So when I research and write about you know, constitutional issues facing recent arrivals and non-citizens, I have my own personal story to think about, but I also feel like that is the American dream. That is the dream that we as American citizens believe exists all the time. Our laws, our constitution, our federal constitution, and to some extent some state constitutions provide that there are certain protections that non-citizens are entitled to. And sometimes those protections can sort of get lost in the arguments and the polarization that, you know, exists in our country. However, we are a nation, you know, premised on a rule of law and on the Constitution. And so I write about things to say, well, hey, let's not forget that there this process is in place for a reason so that we don't get blinded by emotion and instead, you know, honor the protections that the Founding Fathers and the United States Supreme Court say exist.
Could you give us briefly an example of some of the more recent projects that that you've worked on or ones that really were meaningful to you?
Recently, I gave a talk at Duke Law School that had a conference called Geography Without Borders. And in essence, what the conference was about was, well, you know, what is the non-immigrant experience and, you know, how does the United States react to that? And so part of it was, part of my talk was just a sort of analysis and an invitation to think very, very hard about why it is that right now there seems to be a lot of anti-immigrant attitudes in the United States. And so a lot of it is economic-based. When people are hurting on an economic level, we tend to be less opening and less welcoming. And so that was part of what, you know, I asked everyone to think about. Also, I tried to get everyone to understand that what we're talking about right now, the attitudes towards immigrants, this is not new. The United States has gone through this kind of thought process and since basically we were founded. So it is part of our national experience. Mm-hmm. We are a great melting pot, but it doesn't necessarily mean that that process of assimilation is ever very easy. And so the thought was, you know, why is it that we haven't gotten our arms around this? Like, why haven't we really come to a decision about what we feel about, you know, immigrants and non-citizens and who we're going to, how we're going to welcome them and how we fold them into our society? And ultimately, at the end of the day, I think the problem is that our immigration code, the laws that you know, basically tell us how we are going to handle non-citizens, that is very outdated. It was passed in 1952, and Congress has been sort of modifying it in little bits here and there ever since, but it is not working. And if you ask anybody, either on the left, the right, the middle, independent, whomever, everyone agrees that that immigration code needs to get revised. But we need Congress to do it, and they've got to get the willpower to do it, and there has to be some sort of compromise and decision-making. Mm-hmm. So until that happens, I think, unfortunately, this kind of topic and the strong feelings it evokes is going to happen again and again.
Certainly a lot to think about, Laura. And as we are starting to run out of time here just a little bit, unfortunately, I want to go back to what we talked about a little bit at the beginning, that idea, which I think you've demonstrated a lot here in the last 20 minutes, of the call to a law being a call to service. We've seen that in your life and in the lives of your students. But how do you work to really embed that into the experiences in your classes in the law school? I know it's part of that broader law school effort.
I do it in a couple of ways, hopefully. One is I try to explain how you juggle, how you can juggle. So how you can have a practice that might be big law the way mine was or might be a solo practice, but still have the ability or be mindful that you need to do some kind of pro bono activity. That really is one of the themes of our law school. So our students get that message from day one of orientation until they graduate. So they are very eager and receptive to how to fold that into their practice of law. The other thing that I try to do, and I don't want to, you know, hit them over the head with this, but also that they need to be mindful that we at the law school and we as lawyers are very fortunate. We've been given a great responsibility. We you know, basically have a very important role in American discourse and American society. And when you have that responsibility, or when you have honestly that opportunity, then you have a responsibility to give back. So that is the other thing that I think I and all of the other faculty do. It's like, you know, you can't just take, you have to turn around and help those people in society who haven't been given this opportunity that you have and this chance to be this, you know, really important person in our democracy. So I think that our students really respond to that message and really understand it. And we tend to call that access to justice. In other words, you know, people who can't afford lawyers, they still need lawyers. And so that is why pro bono is so important. And in reality, all the studies and discussions about this have shown that it's not just the poor who are lacking access to justice, it's also the middle class. And that's a problem. When our middle class does not have access to lawyers, well, we as lawyers need to do something about that. And our students are very much on board with that.
They seem to be getting that message. I've seen in recent years national awards for pro bono work and service, state awards as well. Pro bono publica.
That's right. That's right.
And that's pretty rare for a university.
It is. And it was not just for immigration. We have a very active and thriving veterans clinic.
And the law school as a whole, yeah.
Yes. And so we've got this really active, thriving veterans clinic. We also have other professors who basically perform pro bono activities like for other various litigation efforts, as well as just estate planning and things of that nature. So probably since 2012, the law school has really decided that we're going to try to provide these kinds of services. Again, you know, we don't have clinics, so most other law schools will say, well, we have this clinic and we have students that will perform this activity as a class for an entire year. Our students would do it for nothing. I mean, they just want to volunteer. And that's because of the way our program is you know, created. So we can't really do a typical clinic. So I think that makes it even more remarkable that they're just giving up their time to do this. They're not getting any academic credit. They just want the chance to be a lawyer.
A real hallmark of Baylor Law School.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Very much so.
Well, Laura Hernandez, thanks for joining us today. I learned a lot, and I appreciate your time and the work you all are doing.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. That is Laura Hernandez, Baylor Law professor and co-founder of the Baylor Law Immigration Clinic. I'm Derek Smith, and this has been Baylor Connections. Thanks for joining us today and each week at 11 a.m. on KWBU-FM Waco. You can listen to this and all other Baylor Connections programs online at baylor.edu/connections. I'd like to thank KWBU station manager Brody Basha, also Cassie Bowers and Lori Fogelman from Baylor Marketing and Communications for their assistance. Thanks for joining us on Baylor Connections.